Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, two really fascinating conversations. Governor Jerry Brown, the four-term governor of California, is with us, plus Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us as well. We'll talk to Dr. Drew second. We talk to him about the effort to make America healthy again. What does that mean? We talk about his friend, Dr. Mehmet Oz, being appointed by President-elect Trump this week, and Bobby Kennedy Jr., somebody he knows pretty well, being appointed by President-elect Trump, and some of our shared experience during COVID when we hosted a show together every night for a year. But let's begin with an exclusive interview with former California Governor Jerry Brown. It's the first time that he's spoken out since Donald Trump's win. It's full of newsy, interesting comments about why Trump won, why Democrats lost, how they lost touch, where the party should go from here, his thoughts about Governor Newsom, about crime in California, about nuclear proliferation, about China, about his life on a ranch, living basically off the grid. It's a fascinating conversation. We couldn't fit all of it on TV, but you get all of it here on the Issue Is podcast. Here is Jerry Brown. Governor Brown, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
And thank you for giving us the exclusive. We appreciate it.
Yeah. By the way, here we are in 2024. It's 50 years this year, back this month, that I was elected governor of California the
wow.
first time.
Wow. Well, nobody's seen all the stuff that you've seen, which is why we're so grateful to have your perspective. Big moment in American history. Why do you think Donald Trump won?
For a number of factors. But first of all, there was a lot of discontent. The Biden administration was not popular. People had a memory that was positive of the 4 years under Donald Trump. That's what they told the pollsters. So you had Trump, even though he has a lot of controversy, a lot of warts, a lot of strange things, the majority of people thought they were better off during his 4 years. I think that was the predominant factor, but also I think the wars, the nightly specter of all the bombs going off in Gaza and then Lebanon and in Ukraine, all that creates a real discontent and a feeling we got to change something. Something's got to give. So they voted for Trump. Not a lot, 49.9%. So he didn't get a majority, but he came very close.
Some have speculated that this wasn't as much a Trump win as a Democratic loss. Why do you think the Democrats lost?
Well, because the Democrats had the House, they had the presidency, they had the Senate. So when there's discontent, the inflation, people don't like what's going on, all these wars, they vote out the incumbents. You know, if in doubt, throw them out. That's the mood. And there's a pendulum. There's a swing. After the elder Bush served 4 years, Bill Clinton came in. After Bill Clinton, then Bush. And after Bush, Obama. After Obama, you got Trump. After Trump, you got Biden. Now you got Trump again. This same thing in California. My father was governor. Then Reagan came in. Then I came in. Then the conservative George Dumigian came in. So people want to express themselves when they're not so happy by changing the leader. The president or the governor, that's exactly what happened.
Well, speaking of that, we know you are a few years older than President Biden. You've known him since the 70s. What do you make of the way that he was treated? Should he have gotten out earlier? Did the party do the right thing in trying to get him out in the middle of the summer?
Well, look, he was slowing down, no question. And I don't think it's a news flash that when you get in your 80s, a lot of people fall by the wayside. I keep in good touch with my high school class, and half of them are dead, more than half. And a lot of them are slowing down. So that's just where you are. And I think Joe was around. He stayed. He won. But he definitely had some deterioration there, and that didn't help. You got to be vigorous. Especially when you see all that war going on, you're looking for a lot of energy in the leader. And for all the various reasons of age and health, Joe couldn't portray that in the way that people wanted. And Trump, for all his foibles and all the things he does, you know, from the lies to the philandering to the this and the that, he's got energy and he's a phenomenon. He's a force. And that was powerful.
Do you think that Biden should have gotten out sooner?
Yeah, I think that's an obvious. You know, why did he hang on? We do that. Mayor Curley, famous politician in Boston many years ago, said there's only two ways to get out. They either carry you out or they throw you out. Some people stay to the bitter end and they throw them out. Some people die in office. But this politics is addictive because it's exciting. It's a kind of psychic cocaine. And you're constantly getting stimulated by all the conflict, the fear, the triumph, whatever. And people don't want to just go back to their former boring lives. That's just the way it is. So people don't like to give up.
Was it hard for you to walk away? Do you miss the cocaine?
No, not at all. Of course, I had a lot of it. I had my share. I got to be governor four times. I got four elections. I got a nice defeat from Pete Wilson for the Senate. And I had a lot. I mean, I did a lot of elections. You put that list, even left one off. I was elected to the Los Angeles Community College Board of Trustees.
Yes.
There were 114 candidates. I came in one. That's an adrenaline high. So, but how much adrenaline do you need? I'm back at my ranch. We got the coyotes and the rattlesnakes and the elk and the rain and the trees. It's a good anecdote. So you have the cocaine high, and then you have the pastoral peace of Colusa County.
Yeah, we won't even get into the 70s when there were some real cocaine highs happening. I don't know if that happened with you.
No, as a matter of fact, no. But I don't talk about that anyway. But it was a lot.
Yeah,
there was a lot going on.
You hang with some pretty cool musicians back then. So you were governor during the first part of Trump's presidency. We have some video of both of you at the Woolsey fire. I was out there with you for that. It was right when after Gavin Newsom had been elected, he was governor-elect at that moment. So you know what it's like to deal with him. What is it like to be a governor and have to call him, to interact with him? What's that relationship like?
Well, in the limited time I had, he was very gracious. As I say, he's got a lot of energy. He's interesting. I sat in the helicopter with him for 45 minutes, with Newsom, with General Kelly, with Jared, his son-in-law. He did 95% of the talking, but there's an energy there. There's an excitement. And he later then took us back on Air Force One, the first time I was ever on that plane. So, and I think I talked to him once about an emergency declaration because of the fire. So my experience, very limited, but very positive.
Interesting that you say that. Where do you think the National Democratic Party should go from here? How do they get back to winning?
I think they have to have a very simple but strong economic message. I'm just looking at the latest California report by the legislative analyst, and it turns out that the income is good, but it's concentrated in the higher incomes. It's from stock and bonuses. The vast majority of Californians don't get that kind of income. So it's a skewed economy, and the Democrats have to respond to that. And they also have to deal with all the wars, because when I was growing up, they always said they were Democratic wars, because World War I, World War II, and the Korean War all had Democratic presidents. So that's always a concern. You've got to speak to the international issues to create a sense of security, and you have to deal with the economics. And I think some of the other collateral issues we have to minimize. There's an awful lot of cultural disputes and different things that get people very excited. But at the end of the day, presidencies change based on how people are doing and how they perceive they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's the job. You know, Harry Truman, when he beat Dewey, that was an upset. 48, I was 10 years old then. He went around the country, give him hell, Harry, and he blamed the Republican Congress, the do-nothing Congress. It was a very simple economic message. It was not complicated. It didn't get into a lot of other controversies. It was all about the forgotten American, the average American. We're going to help you. And Trump takes up that line. I think his whole program is not going to do that. Tax cuts that primarily help the rich, that's not going to be any good. Putting a bunch of tariffs will raise the cost of everything you buy at the store. So the Democrats have a great chance, but they got to get down to the basics.
Well, and what is that message? Because you think about almost your entire life in politics, going back to Harry Truman, the Democrats have always been the party of the working class. The Republicans have been the party of the country club. And now we're seeing that start to change. What is that message real concisely for the Democrats?
Well, you know, there is a gap here between the people who went through college and certainly the ones who got advanced degrees, PhDs, law degrees, medical degrees, and people who just got out of high school, and they're in a much uncertain world in the economy, and they use different language. They go to different movies or different television. So I think Trump was able to adapt the language of this people weren't as well advantaged, and there are a lot of those people. They used to vote Democratic. So the fact that they're going Republican. West Virginia went so Republican that so many working class people is a wake up call. And Democrats got to, get off the college campus, start spending more time at the mall and in factories and in ordinary offices where we politicians call the real people spend their time. So we got to get more real, more down to earth in the language, in the policies, and the way we show up. In the world.
We are talking with Jerry Brown, the four-term governor of California. What do you make of the job that your successor, Gavin Newsom, is doing? How do you assess how he's doing?
Well, I think he's doing pretty good. I like him, particularly what he's doing on climate. And now he's riding a very good budget wave. One of the things I have to tell you about governors, most of the time they hit a recession. And when they recession comes, the money for the state declines, and people always blame the governor for that. So, but when things are good, then they like what you're doing, and things have been good up until relatively recently. So I think Gavin's had a good run, but he's had a good economy, and he's been innovative. I think he's, I'd say on balance, very good.
You've talked about when you were governor, but then interested in running for president, how that maybe distracted you a little bit. Are you concerned that that may happen with Governor Newsom? Do you have any advice for him in terms of that, in terms of being governor, if he's actually interested in running for president?
Well, I ran for president 2 years after I was elected governor, so that didn't go over so well. He has more time because he's already been reelected. I would say this, running from California is very difficult. It's 3,000 miles away. And if you leave to go campaign, then you're not in office. I think Reagan knew that. That's why he was most successful and most serious after he'd left the governor's office. So I don't think it's a good position. When you're in New Hampshire, or rather you're in Massachusetts, like Governor Dukakis, you're right there. If you're in Clinton, he came from Arkansas. Yeah. Obama's Chicago. It's only a couple hours away. So I think it's difficult, inherently difficult. Richard Nixon ran for president from New York, even though he was a senator from California. So I just say you got to stick to the home front. Do your job. People elect you for one thing. And if you start going for the brass ring and apparently not paying attention to what they elected you to, they don't like it. And my poll numbers will validate that claim.
You know, it seems like there's a changing feeling when it comes to the California electorate when it comes to crime. We've seen these great pendulum swings throughout California history. We see recently Prop 36, the effort to reform Prop 47, passing overwhelmingly despite a lot of Democrats opposing it. We've seen progressive DAs in L.A., Oakland, San Francisco all losing their jobs in various ways. How do you see the pendulum swinging here, and how do you think Democrats should react to that?
Well, the pendulum's obviously going to swing. If you walk down the street and you see people shooting up heroin, sitting in a tent, if you see break-ins, if your own car is broken, as most people have experienced, they're not going to like it. And for some reason, which I can't understand, the police, the DAs, and the judges are not enforcing misdemeanors. And that's why you got this Prop 36, because shoplifting, you get caught, that's a year in jail. You get caught twice, that can be 2 years. but they didn't enforce it. So now they've made shoplifting, shooting up or selling drugs. It's a felony now. It used to be a felony. So they can put people in jail. That's a hammer. And with that hammer, you'll put more people in rehabilitation. So whatever reason, I think they could have used the misdemeanor, but for some reason, everybody gave up on it. And therefore, the people voted by overwhelmingly. They want it stopped. They want shoplifting punished. They want drug use, particularly when they can see it, stopped. And I think that's the meaning of 36. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican or somewhere in between, that's the way people want it. And I know I was there when the crime issue really rose in the as I left in 1980. That's why Duke Majan beat Tom Bradley. And then, by the way, he went and he built after Duke Majan and Wilson, the 16 years after me, they built 20 prisons and we had massive prison overcrowding. So you get this pendulum where you lighten up and then things get out of hand and then you toughen up. And then you overcorrect and people say, oh, more, we got to do some reform. So it's a constant ebb and flow. And right now I'd say it's flowing toward a more punitive. I want to call it punitive. They want to get serious about crime. They don't want to indulge.
And of course, the United States Supreme Court said that it was cruel and unusual punishment in California because of the overcrowding situation. Then you had to deal with trying to figure that out as governor. You were really known for having a real good touch on where the electorate is at. If you had to succinctly say where the California electorate is at right now, how would you describe it?
I think they're concerned. I think there's anxiety in the world. We're in a very dangerous time. The economy is uncertain. I was looking over a book I have on all my classmates that was put out a couple of years ago, and I was amazed at the number of people, classmates, who had job 40 years at the Bank of America, at Wells Fargo, an insurance company, 35 years as a teacher. This was a steady time, and people could buy a house. That isn't true anymore. There's a lot of uncertainty. So Democrats have, first of all, can't be too complicated. They got to get it simple, and they got to express the feelings of people and come up with answers and find out how to build more houses, find out how to get the streets cleaned up, not tolerate the kind of petty crime that drive people crazy. So it's not complicated. You can't get fancy. And you got to deal with climate change because the fires and the floods are not something you can forget either.
Let's talk more about that issue. You are the chair of the California China Climate Institute at UC Berkeley. We know you traveled to China as governor. What do you make of how a potential President Trump wants to increase tariffs will impact our relationship with China and what that might do when it comes to climate?
Well, certainly there's a lot of hostility in Washington toward China. China's got a very different form of government. It's a communist party, a very tight control. They don't tolerate dissent. So that's all true. And the politicians jump on that. They love to attack China. But the fact of the matter is, China is 24% of the world's population. They generate 30% of the carbon emissions. We generate about 11%. We can't solve the problem of climate without China. We can't have an American prosperity without some kind of serious economic relationship with China. If we try to go it alone, we build up a tariff wall, everything will get more expensive. It's going to be very difficult for America to compete in the world. So we got to deal with China, even though that's very unpopular. And we got to get over the fact that not everybody wants to be like America. There's different. It's different in Russia. It's different in Africa. It's different in Cuba. We got to learn to live realistically on planet Earth. There's 8 billion people. There's a couple hundred different governments. And the most important thing is avoid climate disaster, avoid the nuclear war, which is getting closer and closer, and avoid the bio threats that can come from pandemics or engineered pathogens that terrorist groups can do with artificial intelligence. We're at a very dangerous point with the powerful technologies that have been invented. And the point being, we have to collaborate. You got to talk to Putin. You got to talk to Xi, like it or not. If you don't, and we get into a war, get into a massive pandemic, and the top people have not done their best to work together, we're all going to suffer massively.
I know this is something that you're really passionate about. We talked to you right before Governor Newsom went to China. I was with him on that trip. And I'm curious, on this issue or other issues, do you talk to Governor Newsom?
Not all that often. I've talked to him really a couple of times since he's been a governor. I've talked to him before, but never that much. Look, when you're a governor, you got a lot to do, and you're primarily focusing and surrounded by your staff, by your supporters, by your political analysts. It's a very intense program. It captures your mind. I can tell you, I focused on governor. A lot of your old friends go by the wayside and you focus on what you're doing. Newsom is a very focused guy. He probably wants to be president. He wants to be a big success as governor. He wants to be the first on many things. And if you do that, you got to pay a lot of attention.
Well, you talked a little bit about the nuclear threat. You are the executive chair of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Are we getting closer or further away from nuclear war?
We're getting closer. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts out the doomsday clock, which is a metaphorical way of describing how close danger is. And last year we said we set the clock at 90 seconds to midnight. We have Putin threatening that. We have the Chinese going to build another 1,000 nuclear warheads. We have people in Congress say America's got to respond and build more missiles, more submarines, more nuclear weapons. Well, all that rivalry and competition will result in some kind of a nuclear blunder. It's inevitable. And the only way to prevent it is for the leaders of America, China, and Russia, and even North Korea and other places to talk about the most important thing. Nixon was willing to go talk to Mao Zedong, even though he had tens of millions of lives on his watch. Roosevelt and Truman were willing to talk to Joe Stalin to beat Hitler. The destruction of the world through either climate disaster or through a nuclear mistake is big enough that these other things, however important they are, however strong our beliefs are, we have to realize that survival is the fundamental. We better assure that first so we can argue about the other stuff.
Let's end with some fun stuff about you. We had the privilege of visiting you at your ranch, Governor Brown, and it is extraordinary in Colusa County. What's life like for you these days?
Well, it's been wet the last 24 hours, but we had our eighth olive harvest. We had 100 volunteers out here, mostly some family, but mostly people who worked in the governor's office and worked in my campaigns. And the 100 people picked 2.1 tons of olive oil, of olives, and we're going to have that. It's going to be pressed. We'll probably get 600 12-ounce bottles of Mountain House olive oil. So that was a big success. Then we had to get ready for the rains. And otherwise, I'm doing my work on the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, my China Climate Institute. Also, I've got a charter school in Oakland with 500 kids, 6 through 12. And I do a lot of Zoom interviews like the one we're doing now. So it's busy. But I can tell you, being on this ranch, it's beautiful. It's wonderful to see the animals, the deer, the elk, the coyotes, the cottontail rabbits, the jackrabbits. It's good. It's a good place, and I wouldn't trade it to go back and get into the muck and the mire of the budget and the politics and all the clashing that goes on. I mean, there's a lot of noise and a lot of emptiness, a lot of clashing of clashing of symbols. So yeah, it's a great place, and I like the fact that my grandmother grew up here. As a continuity in the past, it gives me a sense of being somewhere in a real place that has real meaning. I not only live here, I dwell here.
I love that. If only everybody can find a place to dwell. So we'll end with personal issues. These are things that come to mind, first thing that you can think of. And I know you're such a reader. What is the favorite book that you've read recently?
Favorite book that I've read? Jesus. Yeah, I'm reading out a lot of books. I'll tell you, see the bookshelf up right here. What I do is I walk by, pick out a book, I read a chapter, and I go on. I'm reading books on climate change right now. There's one out by a Yale guy, Burning, I can't remember the exact name, but I've just got a hold of it, and I'm reading it today.
Who is your favorite philosopher that you've been thinking about recently?
My favorite philosopher, I would say it's an obscure man by the name of Ivan Illich. He was a Catholic priest, and he left the priesthood, but was a very dynamic writer. He wrote De-Schooling Society, Medical Nemesis, a real contrarian, a type of anarchist who was against all the institutions, but in a very, very interesting way.
Not surprising you would like a real contrarian. What is your favorite meal to cook for your wife?
My favorite meal that I cook for my wife are leftovers. She cooks it the first time, and I take care of it the second and third time.
Okay. And what's the best thing she cooks for you?
Everything is good. Everything's good. Well, we had salmon. Well, we had leftover salmon last night, but it was good the first time and the next two times. And she makes icebox cookies. She's going to make a turkey in a few days. So yeah, she's a fantastic cook. And, you know, I have to go 50 miles to the store. So we stock up and we're ready. We're ready for trouble. We're ready for the rain. And it's exciting.
What is your favorite? Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, another thing we're doing, we got to get our Christmas card ready. So we took the photographs. Now we got to pick them. And then we look at my Christmas card list. I check people off if they're either dead or they don't send me a Christmas card for a couple of years. And then I'll send it out.
I got to get on your list. What is your favorite quote or motto?
My favorite quote? I don't know. Favorite quote? Well, you know, the motto that I put on the Oakland school was a Latin motto, Age quod agis. And that was the motto we had at the Jesuit seminary. And it means in English, do what you're doing. And it means pay attention, be fully engaged, give yourself wholeheartedly to the task at hand. And they used to say that to me because while I was picking grapes, I'd want to carry on conversations about theology or philosophy. And the priest would say, Brother Brown, age quod agis, do what you're doing, pick those grapes.
And there is so much truth that happiness is often being present, which is exactly what you're talking about. So one of my favorite books about you is Man of Tomorrow by Jim Newton. And I love this title because you, even at 86 years old, are still so focused on tomorrow more than yesterday. What do you think tomorrow looks like in California?
I think tomorrow, what does it look like? Well, I think we have a bright future, but a lot of contention. Getting carbon emissions under control will be expensive. It will require rules, and it requires a lot of generosity and people getting along together. But the two parties are very far apart. So I think we have a struggle, but it's still a very rich state. And so I think on balance, I think we'll do well. But we're going to have forest fires. We're going to have a lot of political contention. And who knows what all these tariffs are going to do. I think Trump's going to take away our climate change authority in many respects. So I'd say it's a very exciting future. And there's good and bad. And what gives me hope is the future is uncertain.
We love that. Governor Brown, you are, as I described, the greatest public servant in the history of this state. It is such a privilege to talk to you and to learn from you, and we love having you on the show.
Well, good. I appreciate the continuing relevance.
That's what we're here for. Governor Jerry Brown, thank you so much.
Okay, sure.
Our thanks to Governor Brown. Now to a conversation with my friend, Dr. Drew Pinsky, and we start with a clip from our show. Back in March of 2020, here is the voice of Dr. Mehmet Oz.
The most valuable thing to do right now, in addition to social distancing, is set up some place where you could go get isolated.
That was March 2020, when Dr. Mehmet Oz joined Dr. Drew Pinsky and myself for a nightly show we hosted throughout the pandemic. Now, Dr. Oz has been appointed by President-elect Trump to serve as the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Meanwhile, he'd potentially work with Trump's pick for Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., another friend of our next guest. Dr. Drew Pinsky is a board-certified internist and longtime TV host. You can find his work at drdrew.com. Dr. Drew, welcome back to The Issue Is. So good to see you.
Alex, I'm sitting here thinking as you are ramping up, my goodness, I feel like we were like war buddies, like we were in combat together. We reunited at a VA center.
Yeah. Although doing it from a studio, a lot better than actually being out
but
in war.
Doing it from a studio, and yet if people remember, all you got to see of us typically was two windows, much like you're looking at now, and they had us separated on either side of the room. Do you remember that?
It was wild, everything that we did during that time. And we'll go back and talk about that time in a moment and about Trump's picks. But the broad idea, and this is really a Bobby Kennedy Jr. idea of make America healthy again, which is something that Donald Trump is embracing. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means asking questions. I don't know if you've noticed, but one of the sort of phenomena that was laid bare by COVID was this phenomenon of you don't ask questions, you just toe the party line, which is the opposite of science, was the opposite of how healthcare has always been done. And just asking, now we can now ask simple questions, and it's really Bobby Kennedy that's been spearheading this. We can ask without any prejudicial sense of what is causing these things. We just need to ask, why so much chronic disease? Why so much obesity? Why so much autism? And we need to answer those questions. That's all. Just answer the questions, not assume we're going to find one explanation or another, but we can now start to look at those things. Now, in the process of doing so, we have to understand that there's been some encumbrances in our regulatory bodies and in our NIH and the research center, and that too was laid bare by COVID.
Yeah. What do you think, though, of Donald Trump, who frequently eats McDonald's and KFC and drinks Diet Coke, being the Make America Healthy Again guy?
Well, the irony is not lost on me, Kelly Alex. I appreciate bringing that up. But one of the things I want to say about that, look, whatever he's done for him, whether or not he could extend his life further, he probably could. But I hope I'm as good as him when I'm his age. But the reality is, be really careful here. There's so many opportunities where we might end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I know Bobby Kennedy, if he is put at the head of HHS, wants to look into agriculture. Now, that business is structured a certain way for a certain reason, and I don't want him to destroy that business. By the same token, I don't want anybody forbidding people from choosing whatever foods they want to eat, even if they're unhealthy. If that's what you're going to do, great. But to be more transparent about these things and to have campaigns to help people make better choices, I think that is incumbent upon us to do.
So during COVID, we talked with Dr. Oz at least once a week, if not more, and his appointment immediately made me think of you. Obviously, he's got a lot of critics out there as well. What do you make of Dr. Oz's appointment?
Well, there have been so many people in the COVID and post-COVID era that have become targets of abuse. And when it comes to people like Jay Bhattacharya and Mehmet Oz, they are poster children for the excesses of people criticizing other people. Mehmet Oz was the chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Surgery at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital for years, when that was one of the highest level of achievement a doctor could have in this country, period. I know Mehmet, he is a brilliant guy. He's a well-meaning guy. He only wants to serve and do good. And now he's at a point in his life where he wants to do that through the political process. I support him fully. And you got to know him a little bit. If you remember during the show, he was the first one that alerted us to the fact, I think I was in South Carolina when we actually first had him on. And we sort of rushed the show to air, and he was our guest on the first night, and he brought up this strange syndrome called cytokine storm, something that none of us had ever heard of before that, and he brought it to us that very first night.
And that clip that I showed at the beginning of this segment was from that night.
Is that that night? Yeah.
Meanwhile, RFK Jr.'s critics slam his vaccine skepticism. They're concerned that that could increase diseases if he says gets away from vaccine mandates for something like polio. What say you?
Yeah. Well, I first interviewed Bobby Kennedy about 2.5 years ago, like really just after you and I stopped working together. We built this studio in our home, and I just started talking to people. There I am with him in Albuquerque, where we were doing a symposium about addiction and solutions for homelessness and whatnot. But he, first night I met with him, he said two things that jumped out at me, like just, I mean, struck me blind. One was he leaned in, he goes, "Drew, you're so brave to talk to me." And I thought, brave that a physician and attorney should talk in a public, that's, that requires bravery. We have a problem. Mm. And then the free speech assault was happening immediately following that, and the Twitter files were laid bare afterwards. So yes, we did have a problem, and that was symptomatic of that. And then number two, he persuaded me, and I've had multiple conversations about him about this since, something that I was not aware of, which was the excessively cozy relationships and the adulterating influence of our regulators and our pharmaceutical organizations. That needs to be unraveled. And also what became clear to me during COVID was that included not just our regulatory organizations, but even some of our medical societies and definitely our medical publications. Throughout COVID and in the years following COVID, the publishing process was severely adulterated, and you could see it loud and clear because there were no dissenting data presented on topics that were important. And that's never been the case in the medical literature. It's always a back and forth until you reach a consensus between the positive results and the negative results. You only saw positive results in certain areas, and that you knew immediately there was some problem with that. So I look forward to him, and he knows how to do that. He knows how, I mean, that's, he turned the Hudson River from one of the dirtiest bodies of water to one of the cleanest bodies of water in the country. And he did it by looking at large organizations, looking at their adulterating influences, untangling it, and getting things right. I welcome that.
So how do you think healthcare changes with RFK Jr. as HHS secretary, if he's confirmed?
I don't think healthcare changes so much as pharmaceuticals change. I don't think we'll see them advertised on television. I think the way we do medicine and the way we approach our responsibility as physicians is going to change a little bit if we can remove some of these adulterating influences. Like, you and I had an exchange once that I will never forget. We were talking about, I don't know, one of the drugs of the day that were controversial. And I said something like, you know, I don't, you know, if physicians want to do that on behalf of their patients, they need to be at their liberty to do so. And you said, what about the FDA? And I thought, oh my God, people think the FDA determined the practice of medicine. I taught medicine for years. Here's some words that never came out of my mouth. What does the FDA think about this? Ever. Mm. The FDA has no effect on the practice of medicine. What it affects is what pharmaceuticals and medical product suppliers can bring to market and under what conditions. What we do as physicians is entirely up to us. But the range of what we can get, the data about what it is we are doing, particularly in the oncological space and in the autoimmune space, that data needs to be improved. The publications need to be cleaned up. And then that relationship between regulators and pharmaceuticals needs to be teased apart.
And lastly, we were together for so much of COVID, and the way people think about that period is different now that we have 2020 hindsight. What do you think is the biggest lesson, biggest takeaway from that period?
There were so many. For me, when you say that, what occurs to me is the black white, so to speak, the no gray thinking that people have about that period. And you and I both know, Alex, every night we were just navigating, right? We were trying to figure out what's right, what's wrong. I remember we were in there the night they decided to close the schools, and we had somebody from the school board, and I was like, who told you to do this? I've revisited that tape a number of times. No consultant, no doctor, no public health official. He said, it's just the right thing to do. And that those sorts of excesses and the lack of risk-reward analysis and the, you know, all one way, all the other way thinking was the enemy. Things are very nuanced in medicine. For instance, you can say the vaccine saved lives in the darker hours of Alpha and Delta, at the same time as you can question whether a 22-year-old should be getting a booster in the current era. You can do these things. You can hold two ideas in mind and try to ascend to the truth. It's not all one way or the other. And people have way too much what we call, what I now call irrational certitude. Irrational certitude ruled the day, and it's a problem. And people should be in a healthier space of rational uncertainty.
We'll wrap things up with our favorite game here, personal issues. These are your cultural favorites. First thing that comes to mind, since we haven't caught up in a while. So you ready, Dr. Drew?
Am I ready? It's a relative state question. Go ahead.
What is the favorite TV show you've binged lately?
That I binged on? What's the one that Gene Smart is in?
Hacks. HBO. Favorite movie you've seen lately?
I have not been to a movie in forever, but I am going to see Gladiator 2.
Okay. Favorite podcast other than your own?
There's a podcast called, Sean Carroll's podcast. He's a Caltech professor. He was a Caltech professor about physics. I'm a ridiculous nerd. It's pathetic.
And what is your favorite holiday tradition?
Thanksgiving dinner with as much of the family and extended family I can get together. Thanksgiving was always my favorite holiday because there was nothing but gathering together. And it's a great time of year in this part of the country in particular. I just love that meal.
It's not about who can spend the most money on gifts, but it's about spending time together as a family and eating a lot and football. Yeah. All are great.
Yeah.
So we wish you and your family, your lovely wife, Susan, and your whole crew a very happy Thanksgiving.
You're going to be Dr. a grandfather. Drew. Oh. You imagine that? My son's going to have a baby in January, so get ready for that, Alex.
Happy congratulations to you.
Thank
very
you.
Cool. Grandpa, weird. Dr. Drew Pinsky. Our thanks to Dr. Drew and to Governor Jerry Brown. It's been a real treat, both of these conversations today. Really, really enjoyed them. Hope you did too. I'd love to hear your thoughts about them. Please reach out to me. I'm at Alex Michelson in social media. Love to hear your thoughts. And please tell people about the show. Share it. That's how we get people to know about it. We don't have much of a budget for any advertising or anything like this. It's all about word of mouth and social media and all the rest of it. So really appreciate any help that you can provide. Thanks so much for listening this week. Next week, a special on athletes who serve as we celebrate Thanksgiving next week. But in the meantime, a very happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. We'll see you next week for more of The Issue Is.